The following podcast is broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
This is Tasman Report, your online council news update. In this episode, questions from the Strategy, Finance and Performance Committee. We get an update on the work that's been taking place on Lower Queen Street. And what about those lithium batteries? But first up, the Golden Bay Community Board. It has a new chair in David Knowles. We asked David what was on his hot list for the new triennium.
My biggest hot list is the fact that I want to see more sustainability in Golden Bay. I also want to see Golden Bay become more of a having more say in what our own matters are and actually getting that across. I think those are the two main things that I want to see happen more. So, that the board can actually make more recommendations.
David, are there any lessons you would take from the last triennium into the future?
I think with the last triennium, we didn't really engage with the community as well as we could have. And I think that was actually our biggest hole. This time, I'm already putting out there that we're going to go to six or seven different location halls: Bainham, Pakawa, Onikaka, Upper Takaka, East Takaka, and we're having drop-in sessions for the community to pop in and have a chat to us about what's going on out there, because what do we know about what's going on in Bainham? You know, if your farmer's there working away on the farm, he's not going to drop everything, come all the way into Takaka on a Monday at 1 o'clock to have 5 minutes say at the public forum. So we've got to bring the community back to the community board, back to the community.
Would you agree that maybe the ability of the community board to take concerns and ideas of residents straight to council needs to be utilised more?
That's exactly why I feel it's important to take it back out to the community, ask what's going on, and if something's that important and feels like the right thing, then we follow it through and it comes onto our agenda and we keep building on that. But you don't know if you don't go out there.
That was Golden Bay Community Board Chair David Knowles. And details for the time and place for the community drop-in sessions are on the council website and in the show notes. You're listening to Tasman Report. We go now to the February Strategy, Finance and Performance Committee meeting for two stories. First up was a question about the performance of the national economy and how that is impacting on Tasman.
Councillor Woods. Thank you, Kit, through the chair. 4.2, development contributions. There is a note there saying that these have fallen behind budget, and a comment that the shortfall reflects the impact of current economic conditions. My question is, at what point do we start to think that the current economic conditions are less of a blip and more of a new reality? And at what point will that start to come through to our thinking around growth projections that affect the likes of the community groups that were just here, their expectations of growth in their communities, the long-term plan, and also the annual plan?
Through the chair, so yes, we consider the revenue that we're getting from development contributions and reserve financial contributions as part of the planning cycle. So in the latest annual plan, those numbers would have been looked at. You would have seen yesterday the growth number is 1.3%. I think that's dropped a little bit from our LTP expectations. I think it might have been 1.5. So certainly we phase that in. We put those inputs into the respective annual plans as they come up. So it's like in one breath, we're forecasting lower at the moment. In the second breath, we're actually taking into consideration what's happening in the real world with our planning assumptions going forward.
So are you tipping towards this is a blip or this is a new reality?
My understanding is consensus started to go up.
And that is my understanding as well.
That was Councillor Woods seeking an assessment of the national economic performance on Tasman. Then Councillor Joe Ellis wanted to understand the impact of interest rates on the funding paid out by Council as part of the June-July recovery work.
Councillor Ellis.
Thank you, through you, Chair. Thanks for the report. We'll talk money and debt, it's always depressing. Can I just get some clarification around the funds that are coming from NZTA and NEMA, we're still waiting for that to come in, and so we get funding it in the meantime. Could you please explain what happens with those interest costs in the meantime, and do we have some idea of when that may be coming through, you know, by the end of the financial year? And if it doesn't come through by the end of the financial year, what impact that may have?
Through the chair, certainly at the moment, yes, we wear the interest cost, and I would suggest it'll be very difficult for us to claim that back from NZTA or the insurers. TO or NZTA operate a system called TO where you lodge your claims. They have yet to make that open to us. So I saw yet another email this morning about that it's coming, but at the moment it is taking a long time. So we wear it. We are having discussions with both those organisations. As I understand it, NEMA are not even at a point where they're talking about giving us dollars. It's actually Aon who has the $5 million that they're going to make. So I would imagine that one would be sooner. Again, in that March report, I'll look to provide some more information about the insurance side of things, and the timing of that is probably something I could do to bring you up to speed. It's an extremely slow process. And while we spend the money and pay our suppliers, they're not as prompt.
You have been listening to highlights from the February Strategy, Finance and Performance Committee meeting, and this is Tasman Report. There's been a lot of activity on Lower Queen Street in Richmond since May last year with the Lower Queen Street Bridge Capacity Upgrade Project. The old bridge was about 14 metres long and is being replaced by a new 48 metre long structure which will allow the channel under the bridge to be widened. The project has a budget of around $11.5 million and is running ahead of schedule. Taryn Palmer spoke to Tasman District Council Project Manager Jack Serfontaine about this massive job.
Currently the bridge is designed for 35 cubic metres a second of flow. And in future, we need to increase that to 105 cubic meters a second.
That's a lot of water.
That is a lot of water. And we won't see that kind of water, that flow of water going through there in the next couple of years. But it's with the development in Richmond South and Richmond West, and also things like climate change that we have to allow for. We know that we will get to a point where we will need to convey 105 cubic meters a second through the Bore Creek Channel. And look, if that's going to be 30 or 40 years from now, nobody is exactly sure, but we will. That is what we need to design for, and that's why we are basically building a much bigger bridge than what the existing looks like.
So it's future-proofing. Let's talk about the stats of the bridge, so the new bridge.
Yeah.
How long is it?
It's a 48 meter long bridge, and it's what it's called a three span. So there's two piers in the middle, and there's basically three parts of the bridge that that connect. The bridge will be about 17 meters wide. There's going to be a shared use path for foot traffic and cyclists on the upstream side. And we are future-proofing that by providing an area on the bridge that in the future we can connect a shared use path on the downstream side as well. And that would connect with a possible roundabout at the intersection of McShane and Lower Queen Street. And it would connect in the future with a footpath, cycle path on the northern side of Lower Queen.
There's been obviously a lot of planning. How long has this job been in the works until we got to the kickoff, whenever it was, last May, wasn't it?
It's obviously, if you start looking at from when the first thought about Bore Creek was had about we need to expand the capacity of that creek. That was probably, I don't know, 8 to 10 years ago. But for me, as the project manager for this job, I started working on this about 2 years prior to us starting the construction. And for me, that started with looking at what concerns are needed. We started with with some consultation with our iwi partners. We started, obviously, with the design. There were a lot of things that had to be designed for, because it's not just a bridge that we are renewing there and that we are basically increasing the capacity of, but there's also a lot of underground services that we had to allow for. So the underground services is basically what we took out, we also had to put in, but we had to put it in a place and at a depth that it wouldn't interfere with the new channel. So all up, there has been about just shy of 1,000 meters of underground water and wastewater piping that we've had to renew. There's a little bit of stormwater as well. And yeah, that is obviously it takes a fair bit of time to replace all of that. So that's why the first 3 or 4 months, there was a lot of activity on site, but we weren't actually working on the bridge because we were just working on the underground service that it had to be replaced.
So once those underground services were sorted, then we had to put the bypass road in.
Yes.
And that was another mini project in itself.
Yes, yeah, because also the bypass and temporary bridge that we put in, they needed to be designed for the same traffic as well as water flow as what we currently have. So the temporary bridge is still designed for 35 cubic meters a second, and the temporary bypass, look, we've got over 12,000 vehicles a day going over that part of Lower Queen Street, and that's what you need to design for. We cannot just put a gravel road in there and then expect that everything will run smoothly. And so that's why we had to put that temporary bypass in. It looks really good, and we have received some comments where people are saying, well, haven't you overdone this a little bit? But reality is, with the curves of the bypass and the fact that you are designing that for 12,000 plus vehicles a day, and 900 of those are heavy vehicles, we needed to allow for a really good road surface, because of the turning curves are a bit tighter than they previously were, and those turning curves, they put more pressure on the road seal. So that's why we needed to make sure that we're not going to put something there that after 2 weeks of use needs to be replaced or repaired.
Amazing. So we're on the job now, and how far through are you? Well, what are we doing on site right now? That's actually, we can see the bridge appearing.
Yeah, it's really, for me, it's fascinating to see what is actually happening right now. And it's happening so fast, because last week we put the first span on. So the first 17 beams, there's in total 3 sets of 17 beams, 51 beams in total, that we need to put on the new bridge. So last week the first span was put in, and now you can actually see the extent of that bridge. You can see the full width of the bridge. You can also see the height of the bridge, because the reality is that with this longer bridge, and the fact that we've also got a cycle path going underneath the bridge, we are the road is actually at the highest point about 1.6 meters higher as the existing one. And now with that first span in place, you can clearly see what effect that will have. And it's quite obviously not for everybody to see right now, but when you're standing on that bridge, that looks quite impressive.
Mm, that's great. Yeah. So we're running to schedule. You're happy with the way things are going. What sort of rough time are you able to say at this stage, or is it too early?
No, look, we've got a, by way, the contract Fulton Hogan, they've got a really good idea about what needs to happen to finish the bridge. The good thing is that we, through the project, because we started this off in May last year, and there have been a lot of small gains in the schedule that we made, and they are really starting to add up. Yes, there have been a couple of times when we encountered things that were a little bit of an unknown and that were new to us, but overall, where our baseline program basically showed that we were going to open up the new bridge in August, and right now we are confident that we can bring that forward by about 2 or 3 months, and that is obviously that's really good. It's good for the people that use it. It's good for those 12,000 vehicles a day. It's good for the businesses along Lower Queen Street or other commuters and companies that use that part of Lower Queen Street. So it's good when we finish early.
That's great. Good news all around. And if people want to keep up with the project, we are actually running it on our Shape Tasman webpage on our website. So if people want to go to or search shapetasman.govt.nz, and it's under LQS Bridge, and they can watch. We update it regularly. They can see pictures from the site. So, yeah, excellent job. Yep. Jack Serpentine, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
That was Darren Palmer speaking with Tasman District Council Project Manager Jack Serfontaine about the Lower Queen Street Bridge Capacity Upgrade Project. You're listening to Tasman Report, your online update about council news. Joining us now is Diana Worthy. Diana is Team Leader for Natural Resources, and she's here to discuss the latest annual air quality report.
We do an annual air quality report, and that summarises the monitoring that we've done primarily in the Richmond Airshed every winter. So this is the third year that the Richmond Airshed hasn't breached the national air quality regulations in relation to particulate matter 10. So that's the key one that we're monitoring here. And so PM, it can come from a variety of sources. It's either human-made things, so how you operate your wood burner, or if you're having outdoor fires, things like transport emissions. But then it also covers natural sources, so pollen and sea salt, things like that. And so it's really important that we monitor air quality.
And it looks like people have taken it to heart in terms of how you actually manage your fire, because there is a correct way, if I can use that term, for actually preparing the fire for burning, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. So we promote what's called the upside down fire on our website. You can watch a really cool video from Dave Pullen from the Home Heating Association and how you can correctly stack your wood within your wood burner and light it to make sure that you reduce the amount of smoke that's going into the air.
When we talk about the surveys just primarily for Richmond because of its classification as an area that needs attention, did you get a kind of like a feeling for what's happening elsewhere, or is Motueka, Takaka, are they doing okay?
So we've done historical monitoring in Motueka, but we stopped that a couple of years ago. In terms of the actual national regulations at the moment, it's not breaching it, so that's why we stopped that monitoring. And we've been doing research monitoring across the rest of the district and some of our other townships over the last few years. So we've also covered off Brightwater, Wakefield, Murchison, and in 2027 we're going to go to Takaka. So it's important that we just kind of check in and see how it's going.
Okay, going forward, what are the lessons we need to take forward?
I mean, at the end of the day, we all contribute to air pollution one way or another. So, we can take personal responsibility in terms of, when we're using our wood burners in winter, making sure that we're using dry wood and that we're operating our wood burner correctly. If we have to do outdoor rural burning in terms of, if there's vegetation waste that needs to be burnt, making sure that material is nice and dry before you light it. And again, you can clean it, burn it cleanly. And we've got some really good guidance on our website around outdoor burning as well. And then thinking about, you know, every time you jump in the car, that's creating emissions. So you can have a look at, you know, what are alternatives instead of jumping in the car to go down to the dairy. Can you walk or can you take your bike? Things like that.
Or take the bus.
Exactly.
Diana Worthy, who's team leader for Natural Resources, joining us there to talk about the latest annual air quality report. The dangers of lithium-ion batteries have again been highlighted with several fires in our rubbish collection network. The first fire was at the Richmond Resource Recovery Centre on the cardboard sorting line, while the second was in the commercial residential waste collections truck in Richmond. And a third fire was at the Mareri Resource Recovery Centre, where a staff member noticed smoke coming from a waste compactor bin. Darren Palmer spoke to our waste management engineer, Graham Poxon, about the situation.
Graham, fires caused by batteries being discarded is a real concern. We've had three incidents in the last couple of months. What were they? There was quite a serious one at Mareri Waste Recovery Centre.
Yeah, just before Christmas, we had a fire in one of the compactor bins that was loaded on a truck, so we had to drop the bin, evacuate the site, call Fens, and they put the fire out. We didn't find the source of the fire, but it's more than likely battery. Unfortunately, somebody had dropped pressurised containers in the waste, so they were in the bin, and luckily they didn't explode, so there was no injuries.
But potential there for a major explosion if those things had ignited?
Well, there would have been some sort of explosion. How bad it would have been is another thing. If it was in the middle of the refuse, maybe that would damp it down a bit, I don't know. We had a fire in the MRF, in the fibre bale.
So that's in the Richmond Recovery Centre, yeah?
Yes, yeah, inside the, on the conveyor. Noticed smoke coming off the belt, so they evacuated the building and hosed it down, and it looks like somebody had dropped a battery in one of the cardboard boxes, and it got compacted and went off. And then the other one was a... it wasn't our contractor, it was another contractor. They had a fire on the back of their truck in one of their bins that from the, I think it was a recycling collection, and Fens directed them to our site where they emptied the truck again and hosed it all down, but we didn't find the ignition source in that either because we're a small battery, because you can get a fire from a battery that's in an ear plug or anything like that.
So that's a concerning thing, isn't it? Those minute, they heat up or they get crushed, or, I mean, what causes them to ignite?
Oh, it can be, once they get compacted and they split and then moisture gets in or whatever, they ignite and the lithium goes off and you can't put the lithium out. And the problem is if it gets to a secondary source, paper, plastic, then that's where the real issue starts to arise.
So we've been relatively fortunate in our patch, but Blenheim, they had a major over there, didn't they? They lost the building.
Yeah, they lost the building. Fortunately, there was skylights on the building, so the heat didn't get trapped in and didn't damage the plant. So they are sending their recycling to Christchurch at the moment, and hopefully in the next week or two they'll have another site up and running.
So it's clear danger. It's happening more and more. I guess there's more and more battery-powered devices and things, right through from portable speakers that people have through to laptop batteries and things. We've come up with a new system now of battery disposals. What's involved there? We've got bins around the place now, have we?
Yeah, so we collect household batteries for free, and then we have a contractor that comes in, collects them, sorts out the batteries from lithium and alkaline, etc. And the batteries all go to Christchurch and then they're shipped overseas, the lithium, for processing.
But clearly the clear messaging is any batteries, not in the waste, not in the recycling, use these bins to get rid of them, is it?
Yeah, household batteries. Unless you're sure that it's not lithium. So if you can read on alkaline, it's fine.
Yeah. So you know, but yeah, lithium. So you're looking for Li on the batteries.
Yeah, that's the main one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anything from hearing aids to electric bikes, the batteries on there, the so they can be minute, and those vape.
Oh, vapes.
I have a battery in there as well.
That's interesting.
We collect those just to be on the safe side.
Beaut. Graham Poxon, thank you very much.
Darren Palmer speaking with Waste Manager Engineer Graham Poxon. New battery collection bins have been installed at all Tasman District Council resource recovery centres, and investigations are now underway into installing additional fire suppression equipment. This show is a production of the Tasman District Council, and I'm John Bullock for Tasman Report.
The podcast you just listened to was broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible.